Nigel Robson, the author of a book that I have in my hands, Our First Foreign War, The Impact of the South African War, 1899 to 1902 on New Zealand. Nigel's with me in the studio. Kia ora, Nigel.
Kia ora.
Lovely to have you in. Now, first off, this war, you haven't written a military history. This is more of a story of the impact of the war on New Zealand, as well as what New Zealand did in this war overseas.
Yeah, exactly. It doesn't pretend to be a military history. The book is focusing very much on the impact of the war. It's sort of an inward looking. It's looking on the impact of the war back on New Zealand, rather than, you know, New Zealand's contribution to the war in South Africa. Obviously, sections of the book deal with New Zealand soldiers' actions in South Africa because they were reported in the press, and that influenced people here. But it's not a history of military tactics and battles and that type of thing. It's very much looking at the impact on New Zealand.
When I was a kid, it was called the Boer War.
Yeah, well, it still is in many quarters. The reason I called it the South African War, and that's one of the names that it goes by. It's also called the Anglo-Boer War. But
Which is probably more honest, really.
Because
the Boers didn't necessarily start it.
No, that's my reason for going with the South African War, is that the Boers didn't have sole responsibility for the war, and it seems a bit unfair to name them, to use the name that suggests that they did.
Who was fighting who? I assume the British Empire was one part of the team, otherwise New Zealand wouldn't have got involved. But what was the war over?
Well, there's sort of conflicting opinions about that, but I mean, from a British perspective, the British politicians and imperial organisations tried to portray it as there were two South African republics, Orange Free State and the South African Republic, and the president of the South African Republic, which was in, that's where Johannesburg is. The gold had been discovered in the Rand goldfields in Johannesburg, and the British tried to portray President Kruger, who was the president of the South African Republic, as the guy who was preventing the British miners in the area from getting the vote.
So there were already republics independent from the British Empire at this point.
Yep.
And had they won independence through military action, or had they always been independent?
No, they hadn't been. The Boer population that came to occupy those two republics moved north from the Cape Colony area. Cape Colony and Natal were the two British colonies, as well as there were places like Bechuanaland and so on, but the main colonies were Natal and Cape Colony. And the Boers moved north to escape or to avoid British control, basically. And they established the two republics.
And they were mainly from where?
Originally they were Dutch.
Right.
They were from Dutch immigrant stock, and they were coming to South Africa for religious reasons.
Religious reasons.
What? Yeah, they were a different branch of Christianity. They were devout Christians, but they came from they were from a different stream of Christianity to the majority of the Dutch population,
which was Protestant, wasn't it?
Yes, I think so. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
So they're trying to escape from, to some extent, from British persecution.
Well, I think they were finding the British yoke a bit hard to take, I think.
And, yeah.
As the British hadn't always controlled Cape Colony, and when they got control of it, they then increasingly forced their will upon the local population through laws and so on. And that was anathema to the Boers, who moved north to try and establish their own states, which they did. And there was a war in 1880 between the British and the Boers, but it was quite short lived, and the British lost. It was nowhere near on the scale of the 1899 to 1902 war.
But it was enough to persuade the British just to leave
at
that point.
Yes, yeah.
The Afrikaners. Alone?
Yeah. Yes, that's exactly what happened. Yeah, they granted them independence, but then when gold was found, the Boer states became more attractive, I think, to England.
New Zealand was very keen, or New Zealanders were very keen to take part in this war?
Yes, initially, very much so.
No conscription? It was volunteers?
No, volunteers, yeah. And New Zealand sent 10 contingents to the war, and they grew in size. The first ones were quite small. And they got up to about 1,000 guys. By the last two contingents had about 1,000 men each. And they were always oversubscribed. When they tried to, you know, when they called for volunteers, there were always more volunteers than positions available.
How was it portrayed in New Zealand at the time? What was the call to arms?
Oh, it was very much said in Richard Seddon in Parliament. He was drawing attention to the plight of what were called the Uitlanders. The Uitlanders were the non-Boer population in the South African Republic, and he was saying that they were, you know, our kith and kin. Basically, we were all of the same blood, and, you know, we spoke
because
the same language.
Because they were from
Blighty. Yes, exactly.
He wasn't talking about black Africans, was
no,
he?
No, absolutely no, absolutely not. Yeah, that's a good point. No, he wasn't. But it was very much said and casted in the mold of we were all from the same stock. You know, we all spoke the same language. We all had links to England and the colonies, the British colonies. Were more than happy to participate in most cases.
How many New Zealanders eventually went across
known for certain with any degree of certainty, Brian, because we sent about 6,500 men in New Zealand contingents, but then there were a lot of New Zealanders who also served in irregular units that were raised in South Africa. So there were guys who made their own way to South Africa on ships, in some cases stowed away on ships.
Really?
Yeah. And when they got there, they joined one of the many irregular units that were raised within the country, and they were imperial units but not part of the British Army and not part of the New Zealand Army.
And the response in Australia amongst white Australians was similar?
Very similar, yeah. So a lot of Australians joined, and a lot of New Zealanders, well, I say a lot, a significant number of New Zealanders joined Australian contingents. So they moved to Australia and joined an Australian contingent. And there were cases of of Australians joining New Zealand contingents. So there was a crossover, really.
Well, if New Zealand sent over 6,000 and maybe many, many more, I'm assuming Australia did the same, if not more, and they were just a fraction, this war was quite a big one, and quite
definitely.
A massive scale.
Yes, definitely.
Right?
I mean, it was initially the British didn't have enough forces. So in the very first, the opening battles of the war, the British sustained a couple of fairly large defeats, including one at the Battle of Colenso. And those set-piece battles, it was a bit of a shock, I think, to the British that they suffered reverses, but they did. And then quite quickly the Boers realised that as more and more British troops were sent to South Africa that they couldn't compete. So they changed from, you know, confronting the British Army in set positions to a more mobile form of warfare where they formed what was known as commandos. And the Boer commando was like a fighting force. And they would be moving around the countryside on horses, highly mobile style of warfare.
It was sort of guerrilla warfare,
wasn't it? Yes, very much so. And they were very good at it, and that's where the New Zealanders played quite an important role because they were quite good scouts. So the New Zealanders were mobile mounted forces that would often be operating ahead of the British columns and in a scouting role.
If the Afrikaners, the Boers, were fighting, what was the attitude in Holland to what was going on?
I don't know too much. My research hasn't been really into that. But as I understand it, the Dutch definitely, you know, supported the Boers. I mean, I haven't seen any evidence otherwise.
Not enough to create actual any conflict in Europe.
Definitely not.
They're just across the channel.
Yes, exactly. And Germany also was quite supportive of the Boer position. They accused the British of various atrocities, and that was a real issue in New Zealand because when German newspapers published accounts of alleged activities by the British Army, the New Zealand public went into an uproar about it. There were resolutions passed, and Māori groups passed resolutions supporting the British Crown and their actions.
How dare the Germans accuse us of doing
something bad?
Yes,
very much so. Yeah.
Not that we had done something bad.
Well, I mean, it may well have been. I found no evidence, you know, of the allegations being true, but that's not to say I think that they were. I mean, that they weren't, sorry.
And there were atrocities in this war.
Well,
most wars, it was a nasty business, very nasty.
Absolutely. I mean, I think in. I think those things are quite underreported. So I've come across diary entries where New Zealand soldiers have come across black African scouts that have been shot by Boers. But there were also cases, one New Zealand soldier described a column of Boer forces that they were pursuing, And he said that women and children were evacuating their position, and as they were trying to get away and the men were defending them, the British forces opened fire on the women and children as they were retreating, according to this diary entry.
The Afrikaans people talk about the Great Trek and other things to do with this war. And what are they referring to there?
The Great Trek?
Or was that a different part of Afrikaans history? Am I getting completely mixed up?
No, that was quite a long time beforehand. That was when they moved out of the southern. The Great Trek was then moving away from British.
Okay, right.
Yeah, so moving north, basically.
Many decades or what, a century beforehand?
Yeah, I'm not too sure of the exact time frame for the Great Trek, but definitely it preceded the war.
There were, I think, allegations that Boers were put in what we would probably call concentration camps or things like that by the British.
Yeah, they were. I mean, the term concentration camp appeared in the newspapers at the time, and it didn't have quite the connotations that it has today. But that's very much what I mean. In the public eye, it didn't have the same type of connotations. But they adopted a policy of trying to deny the mobile Boer forces their support networks. So New Zealanders and British and Australians were heavily involved in operations where they would go to Boer farms in isolated locations, kill all the livestock, burn the farm, and then in one case, a New Zealand soldier described leaving women and children weeping over the wrecks was the quote. And another New Zealand soldier complained about, he said that they were heartily sick of making war on women, children and cattle, I think it was the quote. You know, because they didn't like this idea that they were having to kill livestock and then basically turn these women and children out on their own and burn their houses.
Left in the staff.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure that that's actually how often that happened. I mean, I assume in some cases it probably did. But they were incarcerated in these concentration camps. And sometimes the New Zealand forces and the British forces would try to portray that as an act of kindness. You know, if they left them on the veld alone, they would, you know, they would experience all manner of hardships, and that going to the camp was, you know, allegedly not such a bad thing, but many, many people died in the camp, so it certainly wasn't an enjoyable experience.
Two things must have come back eventually. One must have been news of some pretty serious setbacks for the British Empire, the empire on which at that point the sun did not set. And secondly, maybe some soldiers coming back a bit disillusioned with what they did for king and country.
Yes, both of those things are true. As I say, the early major defeats that the British sustained in set peace battles were a shock, I think, to the British Empire that they could be defeated by what was portrayed as a nation of farmers. The Boers were quite adept at they fought the style of war that suited them. They were very mobile. They had very sturdy ponies. They would, shoot and scoot, I think, is the expression they use, not at the time, but it's used nowadays, where they would, they would ambush a British patrol and then quickly remove themselves from the scene. And they were quite successful in those kind of tactics. But New Zealand soldiers, there was one guy who was present at one of the British victories, and it had been really horrific. You know, the British artillery had shelled a Boer position, and this guy had to clean up the aftermath, and he wrote a really just a horrific account of it that was published in the Whanganui Collegiate School magazine, oddly enough. And he said in that he would be a supporter of the peace party when he came back. He was really disillusioned. He said that if any person saw what he had seen, their martial fervour would be quenched forever. So it's horrible.
You mentioned that the Anzac spirit and the fact that were New Zealanders and Australians knowingly working together in South Africa?
Absolutely. I mean, in the sense, when I say together, I mean, as I said, there were New Zealanders and Australian contingents, there were Australians and New Zealand contingents, and in some of the major, some of the more serious engagements that both Australia and New Zealand were engaged in, or involved in, I should say, they were fighting side by side. So there was a battle at, it was called Bothersburg or Langevaart, and that was an engagement where a Boer commando broke through the New Zealand line. The New Zealand line was trying to contain this Boer force and prevent them from leaving the area, and they attacked at night under the cover of a herd of cattle. And when the New Zealanders sustained, I forget the exact number, I think 18 dead, I think it was, which was the largest amount of dead in a single engagement for the New Zealanders. and they were fighting right beside the Australians. The Australians were literally there where their line ended, the Australian line started. So, you know, the Anzac spirit, you know, that's referred to obviously didn't exist in South Africa. The term Anzac wasn't even coined at that time. But what I'm talking about is the camaraderie between Australian and New Zealand soldiers that has been characterised, you know, as existing in Gallipoli, existed in South Africa.
Well, the interesting thing is that that proceeds, almost coincides with Australia becoming a Commonwealth rather than the bunch of British, individual British colonies. It became a Commonwealth, what was it, 1901 or something, around about then? Yeah. And New Zealand had the opportunity to join the Australian Federation, and we said no. But, you know, we were invited. We could have become part of Australia. And so I'm wondering whether people even thought about themselves as being Australian, New Zealand then in those terms. Maybe some didn't.
Oh, I totally agree. I mean, one of the things that comes out quite strongly among the New Zealand soldiers, or sorry, the guys who were in New Zealand contingents, was that there were many nationalities. You know, a lot of the guys gave their country of birth as England and other parts of the colonies. You know, we had a real mixture of people in New Zealand at the time, and you know, it's quite hard to identify how do you define a New Zealander? You know, what was a New Zealander? Did you have to be born in New Zealand? If that was the case, there were many guys in the New Zealand contingents who would not qualify as being New Zealanders. You know, the extent to which we, as a country, felt some kind of bond with Australia, I think, is harder to define. But, you know, on the battlefield, definitely there were cases, as I say, where they were sharing the same, the same shell holes in some cases.
Did any Māori go across?
Yes, absolutely. They were officially Māori were prevented from joining their contingents. Because the Secretary of State for the colonies, Joseph Chamberlain, he used very diplomatic language, but there were when war broke out, there were offers almost immediately from the British colonies. So Australia offered troops, New Zealand offered troops, Canada offered troops, and all of those were accepted by Chamberlain. But he declined troops from Lagos, he declined troops from Hong Kong, from the Strait Settlements, which is Malaya, and obviously Māori as well. And the language that he used when he was the language that was used when he declined Māori participation was that it was circumstances peculiar to South Africa. I think was the exact quote.
See, here we have this war between the British and Dutch descendants on African territory, and yet the Africans, the indigenous Africans, well, they're kind of what was happening to them.
Well, I mean, in many cases, they
caught in the crossfire.
Yes,
they whoever were, wins, we lose.
They were definitely impacted by the war. I mean, they I'm not sure if you're aware, there were three major sieges at the start of the war. Three towns that were besieged by the Boers, and one of those was the town of Mafeking. And Baden Powell, who became famous as the founder of the scouting movement, was the colonel in charge of that. And I've seen a diary that was written by a New Zealand soldier who was besieged in Mafeking, and he said that he'd seen black Africans eating the soles of cooking the soles leather soles of shoes and eating them, and they were the British forces were paying the African population to do various tasks in the town during the siege, and when he was. The guy that the New Zealander who wrote this was the paymaster, so he was paying these Africans for their work, and he said that they would just fall over, you know, from weakness because of lack of food, and obviously during the siege it was hard for the entire population of the town, but infinitely worse I think for the Africans.
In terms of warfare, it's kind of on the cusp of, well, it literally is. It's in two centuries. How much of the horrific war machinery that was to cause so much carnage less than two decades later was already in use in South Africa in 1899 to 1902?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, the artillery, for instance, was, you know, well developed, and war technology is continually advancing, so it's always getting better, and I'm sure in the period from...
Or worse, depending on your point of view.
Yeah, exactly. No, that's a good point. From 1902 till 1914, I'm sure there were developments in artillery, but the British were using a type of high explosive called lyddite, which apparently just was horrific. And if the lyddite shells exploded in the vicinity of the Boers. It was terrible for them. That's what the New Zealand guy who described the aftermath of the battle was talking about, the effect of the lyddite shells. But they also had modern rifles. They were using centerfire. The Boers were using modern Mauser rifles, centerfire rifles, and the New Zealanders were using 303s for most of the war. So, you know, it was on the cusp, but it was a
machine guns.
They used Maxim guns, yes. So an early form of machine gun. There was a combination of sort of the slightly more modern technology, but also some of the tactics were quite sort of backward looking, I guess.
The result of the war was, I think, eventually a British victory. The whole of South Africa became a British colony. What was the result in terms of New Zealanders coming back from that war?
Well, I mean, it depends what perspective you're looking at. Obviously, there were a lot of New Zealanders who came back who were injured. In relation to the number of soldiers who went, not that many. We had 182, I think it was, in a 1903 government report. It lists 182, I think it is, casualties. And of those, I think 74 died of typhoid. So typhoid was a bigger killer. But when these guys came back, there were men who had, you know, sustained serious injuries, lost limbs. One guy had been hit by lightning and he was paralyzed, partially paralyzed for the rest of his life. So, you know, there was quite a, that type of legacy was enduring, definitely.
Was there, with the benefit of hindsight, maybe the Boer War the South African War was a real warning to the British Empire about its lack in terms of its reach. But was there any sense among the New Zealand survivors that maybe slavishly following the British Empire in a conflict might not be such a good idea?
Yeah, well, I mean, I haven't seen too much of that in evidence of that in soldiers coming back. There was definitely, there was local opposition to the war, and it was relatively limited. But the people who did oppose it were quite vocal.
And why did they oppose it?
It was a combination of reasons. Sometimes political, sometimes religious, sometimes moral, there was a lot of overlap between the two. There was a guy, William Grattan Gray, who was really interesting. He was the chief editor of. Sorry, chief reporter of Hansard, and he also he was a journalist for the New York Times, and he wrote an article that was published in the New York Times, where he was critical of the wave of patriotism that he described washing over New Zealand, and he lost his job because of that.
Really, if only they'd listened a bit more.
Yeah,
well, so, 15 years later.
Yeah, exactly.
Similar mistakes, only more tragedy. Nigel, it's been fascinating having you on. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks very much, Brian.
It's Nigel Robson, author of Our First Foreign War, The Impact of the South African War of 1899-1902 on New Zealand. And it's published by, Nigel, you can probably tell me this.
University Press.
Victoria University?
Massey University.
Get it right eventually. Thanks very much, Nigel.